My name is Gaetano De Ferrari from Pavia, Italy, and I'm chairing this session with Ileana Pigna from New York.
Good afternoon, everybody, and to add my welcome, I'm Ileana Pigna from Albert Einstein in New York and a consultant to the FDA.
So after having said that, we would introduce the first speaker, Dr. Pocock from London. And the topic is non-randomized and or non-blinded trials. When can they be trusted? What can help them to be acceptable?
Right, thanks very much. I am lean and hungry at this point, so I may be slightly mean in some of my comments about non-randomized trials as a result. But let's see how we go. So, right. I'm talking about non-randomized. And in addition, at the end, a small piece about non-blinded trials, primarily focusing on the device world, though some of what I say extends into drug trials as well. I did press the green button. There we are. And in non-randomized studies, it's fairly obvious that caution is needed in their interpretation. And I'll start with this example from the drug-eluting stent versus bare metal stent issues. And the issue here relates to patients with a QMI, so it's primary PCI we're talking about. And there was a registry, a non-randomized study, published in the New England Journal a few years ago, demonstrating that there appeared to be a lower two-year mortality for patients receiving a drug-eluting stent compared with those receiving a bare metal stent. After doing all the right analysis techniques of propensity-based methods of analysis, and it was pretty highly significant. Now, with observational studies, it's appropriate to use the term associated with, not reduced. So drug-eluting stents were associated with lower mortality. And the problem is this a selection bias of who was going on to drug-eluting stents, or is it a real effect? One's inclined to lean, given that the next trial just coming out very soon after, the Horizons AMA trial, showed an identical one-year mortality for the two types of stent, and therefore you feel there's a clear contradiction between the non-randomized study and the randomized trial. So this one example leads one to a broader setting of when can you trust the registry data in this particular field. A meta-analysis, several meta-analyses have been done. I'll focus on one of them, which looked at the randomized trials of drug-eluting versus bare metal stent in the broader setting of all PCI rather than after acute MI, and they're looking at the randomized trials and the registries. And looking at mortality still, the hazard ratios for mortality, drug-eluting versus bare metal stent. Now, what you find is that with the 21 randomized trials, there was nothing doing. 8,000 or so patients with a mean nearly 3 years follow-up, you found the hazard ratio was very close to 1, and there was no evidence of a treatment difference. In the observational registries, the first thing you find is observational registries are easier to do. It's easier to get a larger number of patients, so you've got more data to play with. And then you get, though, a rather striking result, whichever method of analysis you use, that there appears to be markedly less mortality, 19-20% reduction in mortality, if you were given a drug-eluting stent rather than bare metal stent, and it's very, very highly significant. So the trials, no mortality difference. The registries, lower mortality after DES. So who's right? Why such discrepancies between the trials and the registries? Well, the criticism of the trials is always they're not representative of real-world use. But the more serious criticism, I think, of the registries is they're prone to selection bias. For whatever methods of analysis you do, can you really capture all the selection biases by adjusting for confounders on any analysis technique? And the confounders available for adjustment and what detail you have for them will always vary enormously across registries anyway. So it's not like you've got one uniform base rigor of analysis. So mortality risk depends on so many factors not related to the specific PCI. issues of patient frailty, issues of was your patient's wealth in any way, their insurance, related to whether they got a more expensive drug-eluting stent rather than a bare metal stent. So there could be social issues as well as specific cardiological issues affecting who was at risk of dying. And also the feeling that any true effect, realistically, should be small given all. Method of doing this is you do a propensity score. So you say, of all the features I showed on the last slide, put them all together and more that I didn't manage to list, and do a logistic regression to say what makes you likely to be a CABG patient versus being a PCI patient. So this propensity score is the chances of you getting CABG given what you knew, what the patient profile was. And then we've shown the distribution of the PCI patients compared with the distribution of the CABG patients by this propensity score. And it means they are chalk and cheese. You have a vast difference between the distribution of the CABG patients and the PCI patients, the single biggest driver being whether you were three-vessel disease or not, but many other features contribute. So you see, there's a lot of patients who are pretty well destined to get CABG. There's a lot of patients who are pretty well destined to get PCI. But there is a middle range of patients who could swing either way, depending on the individual choices of carers and patients' decisions. I'll come back to this slide in a moment, because I think it's quite important in the method of analysis. So what they did was... Well, that's a good way to slow my pace down, but... They then adjusted the rates of survival using inverse probability weighting, which I'll come back to in a moment. So they did an adjusted analysis comparing the survival of the CABG patients with the survival of the PCI patients, taking into account trying to sort of match like with like in spirit. And you can see what happens is a short-term, well-known higher mortality after CABG, but in the long run, you see a highly significant difference between CABG and PCI patients. So at 4 years follow-up, you're estimating roughly a 4.4% greater mortality if you've got PCI, adjusted for everything in sight. And the relative risk over the whole of the analysis is of 0.79. So the relative risk of being dead at 4 years is 0.79 for surgery, so a 21% ratio reduction in the risk of dying if you are getting CABG. Now, the point is, to what extent can we believe that, given the observational selection going into the study? So what we're doing is inverse probability weighting. That is, you weight each CABG patient by the inverse of the probability that they would have been selected for CABG. So what does that mean? Let's go back two slides. That means, in your analysis, these everyday commoner garden, you're bound to get CABG patients, have a lower weight in the analysis. Whereas these rare breed, why on earth were you getting CABG patients, get a huge weight in the analysis. So this patient down here gets more than 10 times the weight in the analysis than this patient out here. Be on your guard. Because these are rare, these are normal for CABG. So it's a rather peculiar technique that is meant to reduce bias. There are two other methods of analysis that could be done. That is propensity matching. So where you can, you match, take any given propensity score, you do paired matching of a PCI patient with CABG patients, and that's propensity matching. So given there are fewer CABG patients, you would match them with a sample of the PCI patients available on that propensity score. The alternative is to do, the third alternative is to do propensity stratification, so that you do an analysis on, say, this propensity score stratified, then the next one, then the next group. So you do sort of stratify by the propensity score in your analysis. And if you're getting tired of the statistical methods, I do sympathize, because it's necessary in non-randomized studies, but does it solve the whole problems? Ah. Am I meant to point this in a particular direction, or doesn't it matter? I presume not. I am pressing unsuccessfully. Has this happened to other speakers, or it's just me? Oh, it has. But am I beginning to become an outlier? Next slide, please. Sorry, what a good idea. Yes, narrow-minded statisticians can't think as laterally as that, obviously. And the next one, please. And the next one. One more. So, you could say CABG appears to have a long-term survival advantage, at least if you call 4 years long-term. Is consistent across subgroups. They did do many subgroup analyses, and one of which was subgroups by propensity score there. And the main problem was residual confounding, and could you really adjust for all the other confounders that might have occurred? Oh, try a new one. It's a battery issue, is it? Thank you. And they did do sensitivity analyses to say how strong a confounder, an unmeasured confounder, would have to be to explain the residual apparent mortality difference. But Laura Mary, in her New England Journal editorial, is not convinced. Now the laser pointer's dead. Life's really good here. Either or. If I could have both, that would be great, by the way. I can do dual action. Never mind. Let's go forward while we're about it. So Laura Mary was suggesting she's not convinced at all. And there were two issues that struck me. One is, how do you capture patient frailty? It's very difficult to measure. And it could be that the patients undergoing PCI might have been, in some sense, more frail, not fit for surgery. And is that frailty really captured in the available confounders? And secondly, the whim of patient choice. Who wanted which? And how do you adjust for that? And so I think there are problems in the observational registry. But we're in the... Oops, I didn't mean that. Yeah. It's always good to see speakers suffer, isn't it? Yeah, okay, I'll try and keep my cool. The syntax trial, okay, it's not quite the same. It's looking at left main and three-vessel disease patients. But at 4 years, as a randomized trial of CABG versus specific tacta stent, it was showing a higher mortality on the stent. And then, of course, we have the latest Freedom trial, and my button isn't doing any better. Next slide, please. Next slide. The Freedom trial is tantalizing what it's got to say about mortality. You know, it's got the wonderful p-value of 0.049, and it's looking at mortality with a hint of a divergence towards PCI having a higher mortality. The trial has a lower rate of mortality than the registry we've been looking at, even though they are diabetics, and that might be a selection process of who could be randomized into a trial. It has to be said that the triple outcome, the composite outcome of death, MI, and stroke, showed a more highly significant difference, which is supportive that PCI does seem to have a higher event outcome than CABG. So why do we begin to believe the registry? Because it's consistent with the trials. So why do you need the registry? It's a circular argument there, which is quite interesting. So a broader view has been that a view in a collection of topics in acute coronary syndromes, these authors tackled the question of, do observational studies using propensity scores agree with the randomized trials? So these authors, this year in the European Heart Journal, took 17 clinical topics in ACS. And within those topics, they found 21 observational studies and 63 randomized trials. So they did 17 meta-analyses of the randomized trials and compared them with the observational studies. And their conclusion was that, in general, for treatment of ACS, whatever the treatment is, observational studies tended to produce more extreme treatment effect estimates. Although often in each individual item of the 17, the differences were rarely statistically significant. Looking at four-year long-term mortality topics, they had a collection of topics here, And this is the relative effect sizes for the observational studies versus the randomized trials. So if observational studies are showing larger effects, you expect the point estimate to be on this side of the fence. And you see that's nearly always the case, though only on two occasions, statins used in ACS, in exercise rehabilitation after AMI, did the difference actually reach statistical significance. So there's a hint that observational studies tend to exaggerate effect. I should change that to say published observational studies tend to exaggerate the effect. Observational studies that did not show such big effects, there's a right just not to bother to publish, and I think that's a real problem with observational studies. Now, briefly, I'll change topic and talk about non-blinded randomized trials. So, randomized trials now, but non-blinded. Can they be trusted? Let me start outside the device realm in new anticoagulants in atrial fibrillation. So we have, many of us know, the RELY trial of dabigatran, the ROCKET-AF trial of rivaroxaban, the Aristotle trial of apixaban. And the RELY trial was not double-blind with regard to dabigatran versus warfarin, so it was open as regards whether it was drug or warfarin, whereas these were using double-dummy techniques, ROCKET-AF and Aristotle, to be blinded comparison against warfarin. So the question is, does the RELY trial not being double-blind matter? Does it affect our interpretation of the data? So D for dabigatran, R for rivaroxaban, A for apixaban. So to what extent could it be the apparent best result for dabigatran versus warfarin be a real phenomenon or due to the fact that it was a non-blinded trial for an endpoint such as stroke or systemic embolism? On the major bleeding, did it was the 110 milligrams looking particularly good versus warfarin because bleeding events were in a non-blinded setting? So, firstly, we've got to, of course, beware of indirect comparisons in those trials. So, in comparing across trials, it could be patient selection, outcome definition, the INR control on warfarin, and possibly choice of dose that could have influenced those comparisons. So, the blinding, coming back to that. Of course, in the RELY trial, there was central blinded event adjudication. So does that solve all the problems? Because the event committee can only adjudicate what it receives. And so are there risks that reporting of strokes could have been higher on warfarin as a result of knowing which treatment a patient was on? You can argue that's unlikely. With bleeding events, might be more of an issue. But can you rely on a blinded event adjudication committee to solve the problems? On going to a device trial, a FAME 2 trial, fractional flow reserve guided PCI versus medical therapy in stable coronary disease, recently published. Now, the primary endpoint was a composite of death, myocardial infarction, and urgent revascularization. The trial is underpowered for deaths and myocardial infarction, so the highly significant result on the primary endpoint is entirely dependent on urgent revascularization, with a very striking difference. Now, it's unlikely you could explain that by any... I'm sure there is a real phenomenon going on here, but to what extent did open investigator reporting at least affect the result partially? Could it be that the definition, the selection of whether a revascularization procedure was urgent or not could have been influenced by the investigator knowing which treatment group the patient was on? Is that possible? And is the was of course blinded central adjudication, but that can really again solve the can that really solve all the problems? So urgent revascularization is a much more subjective outcome than MI or death. So I think when you have outcomes that are more dependent on subjective opinion and the trial is open, not blinded, then I think you have more of an issue. I'm more comfortable with all revascularization rather than urgent. Though then you still have, if the patient was on medical therapy and you know they're missing out on PCI, are you more likely to recommend a revascularization procedure down the line? Of course, it has to be an open trial, probably. These biases may still exist. And the device world, most trials are open, but there is always this potential for some bias in the reporting of endpoint. I think the problem becomes particularly difficult if you're looking at measurements or symptoms as your outcomes in a non-blinded trial. And here it's potentially a bigger problem. Suppose blood pressure is your outcome in a device trial. Then to what extent is knowing whether the patient had the device or not going to influence some process either in the patient or in the measurers as to what the blood pressure is? To eliminate the measurer problem, that I think the blood pressure needs to be measured by persons who are unaware of assignment. And then you need to train patients and disguise anything to do with the patient that might reveal to the person taking the measurement as to which treatment they were in. So attempts along these lines need to be taken to try and eliminate biases in blood pressure measurement. But there's still a problem with a device trial. Still, in measuring something such as blood pressure, can you separate the true device effect from what's really going on in the device, or the effect of just having any old device fitted, the actual package of being intervened on, might influence your blood pressure? And does that matter? Is doing something, if it reduces blood pressure, never mind what it was, is that a good thing? And you may therefore not be able to separate out whether it was the details of the device that were influencing the blood pressure measurement or just the package of doing it. So my conclusions, observational studies of treatment provide real-world experience, but with potential selection bias. Potential propensity score methods, a variety of them can help, but residual confounding may exist. Both randomized trials and observational studies have valuable roles to play, but the latter can mislead. Now, I think I'm being too kind there, and I'd like to quote from John McMurray on heart.org this week. There was some observational studies of treatments in heart failure, drug treatments in heart failure, published this week in JAMA. And John says, John McMurray, what is it that JAMA is trying to achieve by publishing these studies? Don't they think they will encourage physicians to avoid beneficial treatments or even use treatments not known to be beneficial by publishing these studies which have potential severe biases? And so some people are out there saying, don't do it. On the observational study topic. Non-blinded trials need rigorous attempts to overcome potential biases in outcome assessment, and that's a separate topic altogether. Thanks for listening.